Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with a campaign rally last night in Orlando, Florida, at which President Trump launched his 2020 re-election campaign by largely replaying his best of 2016 trashing Hillary Clinton hits, which had the crowd chanting, "Lock her up, lock her up." Will Sommer, a reporter for the Daily Beast, where his latest article is "Police Stop Far-Right Proud Boys from Reaching Anti-Trump Protests in Orlando," joins us to discuss the prominent display of members of far-right cults like QAnon, the Proud Boys, and followers of Alex Jones's InfoWars, both inside the Amway Center and outside, where a confrontation with anti-Trump protesters and the Proud Boys shouting out support for Roger Stone and the Chilean dictator Pinochet was prevented by a cordon of police bicycles. With Trump and Vice President Pence's family present, together with Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz and Senator Rubio in attendance, along with Senator Lindsey Graham, the question arises whether the sometimes reasonable and rational Rubio and Graham are aware of what has become of the GOP. Surely they could not help noticing who Trump is attracting to the party, since they were surrounded by angry members of white supremacist cults proudly displaying their bizarre brands and expressing their unhinged beliefs while threatening the press, who their Führer was ritually demonizing. Then we'll examine the just-released UN report on the murder and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Kamal Khashoggi, which documents in considerable detail what happened to the victim after he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last October, who a Saudi intelligence officer waiting to ambush Khashoggi called the sacrificial animal. And while only 45 minutes of the 7 hours of recordings made by Turkish intelligence around the time of Khashoggi's murder were made available to the UN special rapporteur, the evidence is as damning as it is disgusting. Dr. Ben Freeman, the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy and author of The Foreign Policy Auction, joins us to discuss whether the report will in any way influence Trump and Jared Kushner's unwavering support for the Saudi Crown Prince, MBS, who is likely to reward the Trump Organization and the Kushner Real Estate Company mightily after Trump leaves office, if Saudi money is not already pouring in now in secret. We will assess whether the enormous influence Saudi Arabia buys in Washington will be sufficient for MBS to weather the storm of protest this report will generate after its findings are presented to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva next week. Then finally, we'll go to Kiev, Ukraine, to get a reaction to today's report from the Dutch Joint Investigation Team, who are issuing arrest warrants for 3 Russian intelligence officers and 1 Ukrainian pro-Russian separatist who caused the crash of a Malaysian airliner shot down by a Russian Buk missile 5 years ago over eastern Ukraine, killing all 298 people aboard. Anders Aslan, a former Swedish diplomat who worked in Moscow and was an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, and is the author of the new book, Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy, joins us. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Will Sommer, a tech reporter for the Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and as a political columnist for the Washington City Paper. And his latest article at the Daily Beast is "Police Stop Far-Right Proud Boys from Reaching Anti-Trump Protest in Orlando." Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Sommer.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And it's pretty extraordinary when you look at the coverage of the Orlando launch of the 2020 campaign. Donald Trump, the first family, of course, were there along with Mike Pence, his wife, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Lindsey Graham, most of the, well, all of the Republican congressional delegation, as far as I could tell, Matt Gaetz was there. So they're all there. But do you think any of them noticed that there was an awful lot of Proud Boys and QAnons and conspiracy theories and theorists and InfoWar fans right up front and center that we could all see on the cameras surrounding Trump. Do you think any of them noticed?
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I mean, we're talking about, you know, if we're talking about the case of Matt Gaetz, I mean, this is a guy who up until sometime last year was going on InfoWars, right? So, I mean, he's familiar with this stuff. This is kind of the bargain the Republican Party has made for a while, which is sort of ignoring the kook so as not to alienate their votes. I think what's interesting is that these Trump rallies is really where you see these people alive and in the flesh, and you go, oh, wow, there's a lot of them.
Well, but, you know, do you think they have given poor – this is who we're attracting?
I think they realize that that's, like, you know, a part of the base, and they certainly don't seem to be too concerned about it.
Well, the Proud Boys wanted to go and beat up the anti-Trump protesters who had the baby Trump balloon. And as you've written in your piece in the Daily Beast, Will Sommer, police stop far-right Proud Boys from reaching anti-Trump protests in Orlando. They, but for the bicycles that the cops are riding, there would have been a real bloodletting. These Proud Boys are big, burly guys with their black Proud Boy T-shirts. What is this thing, though, about they love Pinochet, the former dictator in Chile, and they love Roger Stone? What's going on there?
Right. So, I mean, Roger Stone is himself a Proud Boy. You know, he has deep links with the Proud Boys, and he's in Florida. So it's probably no surprise that a lot of the Florida Proud Boys feel very strongly about it. It's difficult, of course, to predict what would have happened had they gotten over to the anti-Trump side. Obviously, the Proud Boys said they weren't trying to have violence. But at the same time, you know, this is a group that has engaged in plenty of political violence at rallies before. The Proud Boys and their members and their sort of allied groups often like to frame it as self-defense, and they sort of get up in the face of the people, and then, you know, they just can sort of engineer a conflict. In the case of Pinochet, they love him because his regime, they threw leftist protesters out of helicopters and murdered them. And so you'll see a lot of Proud Boys and their allies wearing these shirts that say, like, free helicopter rides, or they'll have a helicopter on them. That's what they mean. So, you know, this is a group that ostensibly is claiming to be nonviolent, and at the same time, you know, they're really praising this murderous regime.
So QAnon, an awful lot of the T-shirts with the Q sign, that is one of the most strange things of all, to try and figure out that belief system. The only thing that I can sort of, the audience might be able to relate to is the character that showed up at the pizza parlor in Georgetown and shot it up because he thought he was liberating a bunch of children who were being held by a child pornography ring run by Hillary Clinton out of the basement of a pizza place in Georgetown.
That's exactly
the belief system, right? These guys are on the same page. They believe that a lot of the Democrats involved in child pornography, witchcraft, etc. Can you describe for our audience what kind of political ideology that they represent?
Right, that's exactly correct. I mean, you're referring to this pizzeria thing. I mean, that was called Pizzagate. And so you can sort of think of QAnon, which has been going for about a year and a half now. You can sort of think of that as like a mega Pizzagate. So it incorporates all of that, and then it adds a whole heck of a lot more kind of crazy, kooky conspiracy theories. The gist of it is that, you know, it's based on all of these anonymous online clues that apparently were made by some internet troll, but QAnon believers are convinced that it's a real thing. That these are almost like leaks from within the Trump administration is what they believe. And from there, they think that Trump is kind of secretly battling this kind of cabal that controls the world. It's absolutely crazy. And, you know, it would be funny, but unfortunately, QAnon now has been tied to at least two murders. So, you know, we're seeing the QAnon followers, at least some of the more unhinged ones, get increasingly violent.
And again, I'm speaking with Will Sommer, who's a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and is a political columnist for the Washington City Paper. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is Police Stop Far-Right Proud Boys from Reaching Anti-Trump Protests in Orlando. And, of course, you had, as well, you had Alex Jones people, the InfoWars followers, and Bikers for Trump, who Trump often refers to. They apparently have, you know, fairly about 1,700 members in Florida alone. But what I understand that's going on here, and I've talked to a number of reporters who've covered these rallies in various different venues, and, of course, this latest one last night at Orlando was the launch of Trump's 2020 campaign, which we can certainly talk about what he was saying. But the impression I've been getting is that there's a kind of group of kind of political camp followers who'd follow Trump around at these rallies. A lot of them are in the business of selling Trump paraphernalia, but others are like these Proud Boys and the QAnon people, and it's like a cult. Again, you have to ask yourself, what is it about Trump that is bringing these people out? And, you know, you've got people like Lindsey Graham, who's supposed to be a reasonably intelligent person. There he's got to be seeing that he's surrounded by these people. It just, I find it extraordinary that this is what the GOP has come to.
Right. I mean, this is kind of the, I think in the case of Lindsey Graham, and I think a lot of other Republicans, you know, this is sort of the bargain that's been struck in terms of, you know, in order to get their judges through and in order to get their tax cuts or what have you. These people, especially in the case of Lindsey Graham, who famously despised Trump and was attacking him, and then they say, oh, geez, you know, he can bring us votes and he's getting our judges through, so I guess we'll like him, or at least pretend to like him, and then we won't, you know, attack some of his crazier supporters, or we'll kind of look the other way at some of these kooks who are turning out. I mean, obviously a lot of these people are just regular folks who are really into Trump. But there's this fringe that I think has really been, you know, whether it be QAnon believers, Proud Boys, you know, white supremacists, as we saw in Charlottesville, there are these fringe movements that are very drawn and attracted to Trump.
So the actual speech, though, that Trump gave to launch his campaign, I find it extraordinary. Were you aware that in 2020 Trump is actually running against Hillary Clinton?
Right. I mean, you know, that's another, of course, you're complaining about. Oh, you know, what happened to Hillary's emails, all this stuff, which, of course, is years old at this point. But, you know, at the same time, that's the kind of thing, you know, we're talking about conspiracy theories and stuff like that. I mean, that's both the kind of stuff that gets those people riled up. And it's also, you know, what Sean Hannity talks about every night on Fox News. So that almost is like reciting the litany or the oral tradition of the Trump movement. And that's what the crowd loves. He's playing the hits.
Well, but they're running, I think he mentioned Joe Biden once. But it's sort of surreal that he was talking about the crowd at his inauguration. It was just like, almost like Groundhog Day. He can't get past the last campaign. What's he going to run on? Is he going to run on the 2016 platform? It seems like it.
Well, so, you know, we're seeing him kind of try to shape up what it's going to be. So he's saying it's going to be the slogan now is Keep America Great, and this idea that he just needs a few more years to really get stuff done. Is that going to turn out the voters? Maybe not. I mean, we saw these internal Trump polls that came out just recently that had him getting kind of throttled by Joe Biden. So obviously it's hard to know what's going to happen more than a year from now. But at the same time, it kind of seems like, you know, the crowd kind of seems restless at times. These are, of course, is all anecdotal, but I wouldn't be surprised if Trump and his advisors are trying to cook up, you know, what the next build the wall is going to be.
Well, Trump did get big cheers when he said America will never be a socialist country. So
I guess he's
getting ready for Bernie or Elizabeth Warren.
Right. And well, and you know, of course, this is the other thing, right, is you can kind of paint whoever you want as a Democrat, they can call them a socialist. I mean, we're seeing Mitch McConnell saying, like, D.C. statehood is socialism. So they kind of set these people up as the boogeyman, and then someone like AOC. Then you have someone like a moderate like Joe Biden running, and they're going to say, you know, he's from the AOC wing of the party, et cetera, et cetera. So I certainly think that is a new angle on the platform.
But he is ramping up his criticism of the Democrats, not with any kind of coherence and with any basis in policy differences, but it's really quite poisonous, the demonization, that they're evil, that they're treacherous, traitorous, evil. I mean, that, again, he used the word evil. So that's different, isn't it? I mean, that didn't happen in 2016,
right.
As far as I recall.
That's something we haven't really seen, you know, I think in modern American history, this idea of him, you know, accusing law enforcement and accusing Democrats of being traitors. And so, you know, as we saw, that's kind of what the base loves. I mean, so much of it is being lifted up on Fox News and talk radio every day. And they essentially just, they see the Democrats as their enemies, and they kind of, they want to see them punished. I mean, of course, we got a lock her up chant about Hillary Clinton at the rally. So that stuff's not going away.
Well, I saw some of the coverage of the press interviewing people lining up for the event and buying all the paraphernalia, et cetera, and afterwards. And a woman wearing a sort of pro-Trump T-shirt, middle-aged lady, was, you know, asked about Trump. What do you like about him? Not in a kind of, it wasn't the liberal press ambushing. It was a woman that was genuinely, a reporter who was genuinely trying to find out how this woman feels and wasn't being judgmental in any way. And she said, what I like about Trump is that he tells the truth. I was absolutely floored. What is going on? This is a guy that's told over 10,000 lies. They've all been documented, and he must have told maybe 100 of them last night in the rally in Orlando.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the cognitive dissonance that you get. I've talked to plenty of Trump supporters who say, you know, I like how he's such an honorable man, how much he gives to charity, which is also, as the Washington Post proved, is totally fake. And yet, I think that speaks in many ways to the power of conservative media. They're being told every day this kind of like counter-narrative that often runs against the facts and what is being reported elsewhere. And eventually that sinks in with people.
So what's your sense then of, is there any way at all to bridge this gap of cognitive dissonance? I mean, in other words, the people in my world, we're considered traitors, whatever. There's no way in the world that anybody's going to listen to me that is in the Trump or Fox bubble. So is there anything left in this country in the middle? Is there a sort of constituency left that could be persuaded that this is, you know, one, it's terrible that we're so polarized, and two, that this is just the worst era in American memory, I think, politically speaking, that the evidence is overwhelming of what a catastrophe this man is, both domestically and internationally. And by the way, rather than listen to me trying to struggle to describe how terrible Trump is, just read the editorial from the Orlando Sentinel, which came out, of course, on the day that Trump shows up there. And this is a fairly conservative paper that most often than not endorses Republicans for president. And yet they basically said, you know, this is an early endorsement, and what we're endorsing is we're not endorsing Trump. And then they went on to make very, very cogent arguments about how terrible this man is, both for the security and safety of the United States and the world.
Again, I mean, Trump has a still very high approval rating among Republicans. And I think the plan is essentially to use the Electoral College in the Senate, to use the way the Senate is laid out, to sort of hang on to that roughly 30-40% of voters who also tend to vote more than the rest of the country, and kind of use them like a bunker, and they're just going to hold up and hope that those people stick with them.
And what do you think can motivate people on the other side? If they've got 30-40%, that's a minority. So what about the 60%? I don't imagine most people are as alarmed and appalled by Trump as I am, but I'm stuck with having to kind of cover him on a daily basis. And I feel in doing so, you feel you're compromised because you know you're being manipulated by this reality TV guy who governs by stunt and pulls off these stunts. But watching him last night in Orlando, it was sort of sad. It was pathetic. It was like, oh, God, you know, we've seen this. It's not even a bad movie. It's bad television.
Right. I mean, it really did feel kind of like we were watching reruns from a few years ago. And, you know, this is also, I think, kind of the flaw in the president's strategy, because, you know, this was officially the campaign kickoff. But of course, the campaign essentially started, the 2020 campaign started as soon as he was inaugurated. So we've kind of been watching this now for years, even since the presidential race. So, I mean, in terms of what motivates people on the other side, I mean, just like for Trump, of course, and, you know, obviously the Democrats are making, you know, Medicare for All and stuff like that, and depending on who the nominee is, part of their platforms. But on the other hand, obviously Republicans are favored by a couple structural issues, being the Electoral College, the fact that their voters are older and thus more likely to vote. So, you know, it's certainly going to be a challenge, I think, for the Democrats, no matter who the nominee is.
Well, the Republicans may have the money and the Democrats have the people, but their perennial problem has been how to inspire them. And I don't know about you. Well, I'm not particularly inspired at the moment, but we'll see.
Yes. Well, you know, we have the debate next week.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Oh. I think we'll start seeing the field winnow down.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Sommer, who's a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and a political columnist for the Washington City Paper. And his latest article at The Daily Beast is Police Stop Far-Right Proud Boys from Reaching Anti-Trump Protesters in Orlando. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the just-released UN report on the murder and dismemberment of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
I can see by your eyes you must be lying. When you think I don't have a clue, baby, you're crazy. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Ben Freeman, the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, where he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections. Previously, the National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, where he spearheaded the Foreign Influence Database, he's the author of The Foreign Policy Auction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ben Freeman.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And what do you think that this report that's come out from the UN by the Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killing and human rights is going to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva next week, where it'll be presented and there'll presumably be some kind of a statement issued by the United Nations, but from what the report indicates, and it's based upon 7 hours of recordings by Turkish intelligence, so it gives in great detail what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist, after he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last October. It's absolutely gruesome and grim, but it's so clear what happened. And it's also, I think, equally clear that Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is responsible and should be held culpable.
Yeah, I think, frankly, as you read through the report, it really reads like a horror film, frankly. The details in there are quite gruesome about the way that they premeditated this attack on Jamal Khashoggi and the gruesome way in which they killed him and then dismembered him with a bone saw. And the other thing that the report does, which I think is especially important, is it really traces a pretty clear line all the way up the chain to Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And much like our intelligence services, they issued their report many months ago saying they have very high confidence that Mohammed bin Salman, at the very least, knew about this, if not outright orchestrated it. The UN today has come back and said that they've effectively found the same thing we did. So I think that the only remaining question is, if we have all of these folks pointing the finger at Mohammed bin Salman, what's the Trump administration going to do? Are they going to stick with this line of supporting the Saudis and Mohammed bin Salman no matter what? Or are they one day going to wake up and actually do something about this?
But the United States Senate voted overwhelmingly to condemn MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and hold him culpable. They also voted overwhelmingly, not overwhelmingly, but in considerable majority, to cut off U.S. arms to Saudi Arabia for use in the war in Yemen. Trump vetoed that. They couldn't override the veto, but he vetoed it.
Right.
So he's really sticking
right.
his neck out for the Saudis. And it's worth noting that the new Secretary of Defense, after the current Secretary or Acting Secretary of Defense turned out to have a really rather gruesome and horrible private incident involving his son and his wife that he'd been covering up made public, he is pulled out, Shanahan, and now his replacement is a lobbyist for Raytheon. And Raytheon are the very people who make these precision-guided munitions that the Saudis are dropping on and killing Yemeni civilians with. So this is going to come back, isn't it? But again, it shows you Trump's defiance. So since you follow foreign money and its influence in Washington, is there going to be a crack in Trump? I mean, we can speculate why he is so loyal to Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. I've suggested it might have something to do with being rewarded after he gets out of office with massive investments in his real estate company, if that's not already happening. There's been some evidence
right.
Trump's daughter was given $100 million was given in to her pet project of hers by the Saudis. So
mm-hmm.
there's some indication of that. But at this point, the question would be, what is going to break this? I mean, nobody in the world except Donald Trump and Jared Kushner supports this guy and makes
right.
excuses for him over what clearly happened with Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah, those are all great points. And my mentality when it comes to this is the old Washington adage of follow the money. And that's exactly what we do in my program. And when we follow the money when it comes to Saudi Arabia, we see a lot of money going from Saudi lobbyists to members of Congress to the exact folks that are casting these key votes in support of Saudi Arabia. And then if we follow the money a little further, we can trace a pretty clear trail of Saudi money going directly to Donald Trump and in the Trump Organization, and to Jared Kushner and others as well. After all, even on the campaign trail, Donald Trump, he said at a rally that the Saudis buy multi-million dollar condos from them. And we know from some investigations after the fact, they well overpay for those condos. And so, you know, he's bilking them there. They're effectively subsidizing him. And we also know that immediately after he got elected, the Saudis booked hundreds of rooms at his hotel, many of which they didn't even use. And so they're de facto paying him already. And then there's, as you mentioned, there's the question of what promises have they made for after he leaves office? What deals have they already set up? What possibilities are out there? Because to me, there has to be something, because his, as you mentioned, his level of just unabashedly siding with them is phenomenal. Even a lot of folks in the House and the Senate, members of Congress who we know, who my program has cataloged as having taken significant amounts of money from Saudi lobbyists, even those folks have come around in many cases and have now gotten to the point where as you mentioned, they're going to block arms sales. They're going to try to block the U.S. from supporting the Saudi war in Yemen. And they voted to condemn Jamal Khashoggi. I think what this UN report could do is it could really strengthen some more of those folks. And you might get more folks in Congress and the House and the Senate that tip over again. And so you might see some more votes on this in Congress. And, you know, there is, a possibility that you could get enough folks to where you could override that veto. And then the U.S. would actually be doing something to punish the Saudis on this. But I frankly think they're going to have to do it in spite of Trump. I don't see this as changing his stance. I don't see this as, you know, something that the straw that breaks the camel's back for him. I think he's just going to double down on supporting the Saudis.
But I find it just absolutely extraordinary, though. I don't know whether it's to do with Saudi influence, but, you know, a lot of the reports in the press, for example, about what's happening in Sudan, where there's a sort of pro-democracy movement. They finally got rid of the long-serving dictator through people power, a bit like Tahrir Square back in Cairo a while back. But now the generals, having sacrificed their leader, are cracking down, and the militias are just murdering people indiscriminately and trying to squelch any aspirations of democracy in Sudan. But what's going on behind the scenes is that these generals, nobody supports them except the Saudis and the Emiratis, and one of the reasons they support them is that the Emiratis and Saudis are using Sudanese military mercenaries because they can't get their people to fight in Yemen. So,
that's right.
You know, this is shameful that this country that we support, Trump made his first international visit to Saudi Arabia. It's like his number one priority is to reward them. And they are just absolutely implacably opposed to any form of democracy. They represent everything that's an anathema to what we in the United States think we stand for.
So, yeah, I think that's exactly right. In addition to, you know, being the complete antithesis of America in so many ways, I think it's so critical for people to remember that on 9/11, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. This is a country that has very direct ties to violent extremism, to some very, very harmful forms of terrorism, which have been exported directly to America's doorstep. And the majority of these folks were, a majority of the hijackers on 9/11 are from this country. And yet we still maintain this alliance with them, as if they're our best buddies. I think at least for the one silver lining about all this and Jamal Khashoggi's heinous murder is that I think finally the American people have woken up to this, and that, you know, this is not a good country. These are not really our allies, and maybe we shouldn't keep blindly supporting them over and over again.
Well, you know, there was a brief moment where a lot of people were gullible and went over there, you know, Tom Friedman on the New York Times among them, and declared Mohammed bin Salman the great new reformer. And there were a bunch of Saudi women who broke the law by driving cars. And, you know, those reformers, the so-called reformer, what does he do? He allows women to drive, but he punishes the women who sort of broke the taboo just to that this is how it works. I'm in charge. This family rules absolutely, and you do what we tell you, and you can't take credit for this liberalization. In fact, we're going to punish you. And they've tortured this poor woman and thrown her into jail, and the family can't even visit her. So that's how they do business. This is who they are. So are we going to go to war on behalf of MBS against his enemy, the Iranians?
God, I sure as heck hope not. But we've been tracking this now for almost 2 years, and we can it's all coming to a head now. But we've been seeing it in what their lobbying operation has been doing for years. They've been spreading propaganda about Iran. And let me be clear. I think in many ways, Iran is also not a great country. And I think there are very, very valid concerns about Iran. But I think what the Saudi lobbying and influence machine has been doing, they've been effectively trying to bait the U.S. into going to war with Iran for years. And I really think it's coming to a head now. And I think what people need to ask themselves about a war with Iran is what's really in it for the U.S.? What's in America's interest here? If we're going to go to war with Iran, it sure as heck better be over something that's valuable to the U.S. and not us going to war to fight the Saudis' war or to fight the Emiratis' war with Iran.
Well, today, you know, Pompeo is trying to tie al-Qaeda to Iran, which appears to be a kind of pretext for war because, you know, it's about as absurd as saying that Saddam Hussein was hosting al-Qaeda, which is one of the pretexts for getting into the Iraq war. Well, there's no way in the world al-Qaeda. They hate the Shia and more than anything. So there's no, you know, I mean, it's true that that the Iranians have been holding some members of bin Laden's family. But the idea that what Pompeo is trying to do today, we've seen that bad movie before. But let's just go back to the money trail, which you follow and track in Washington, D.C., Dr. Ben Freeman. What do you know about money that's already changed hands between the Saudis and the Trump organization and the Kushner organization?
We know pretty extensively. As soon as Trump got elected president, it kind of blindsided the Saudis. It was very clear they didn't think that he was going to win. They thought it was going to be Hillary Clinton. And the influence machine that they had already assembled here would have been quite effective at courting the Clinton presidency. And so what we saw was very quickly they hired a bunch of firms with people who were close to the Trump administration. In a lot of these cases, these were newer firms. They were people, you know, with rather tenuous ties to Trump. But they were people at least the Saudis thought could get them the ear of Donald Trump. And when we followed the money trail further as we went along, they were quite effective in getting Mohammed bin Salman very early on in the Trump administration into a direct visit at the White House. He quickly became friends with the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, at the White House. And we learned that through that connection that the two of them have almost daily communications with each other. And then following the money trail further, we also know that during the Trump campaign, he applied for 5 Trump Hotel business permits in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And we know that when he went there, the Saudis spent millions and millions of dollars on his state visit there. And he, you know, quite literally got the royal treatment. What we really don't know, I think, is the next step. What's been promised for after the Trump administration ends? What's been promised by the Saudis to go to Trump, to go to Jared Kushner after they leave office? Because I really think based on Trump's behavior here, there has to be some huge carrot at the end of this that the Saudis are dangling in front of him.
Well, but let's face it, the whole world is condemning the murder of Khashoggi and they're pointing the finger at Mohammed bin Salman. There's only one person or two, if you would count Jared Kushner, who's standing up for him. That's got to be worth something to the Saudis, surely.
Yeah. I mean, for them, it's almost like a fail-safe in that they, despite this multi-million dollar lobbying operation, and speaking of following the money, just to give folks an idea of how much they spend, in just the last 2 years, the Saudis have spent over $40 million on lobbying and PR firms here in America. Their registered foreign agents have donated more than $4 million to political campaigns. They have a who's who. They have former members of Congress on that payroll, too, former senators. They have just about everything you can want when it comes to an influence operation here in America, and it really hasn't been working. Most of that has turned against them, but the one ace in the hole that they still have is Donald Trump. And that, as long as they can hang on to that, I think it's really hard to punish them. And so I think they must really have something good for Trump to keep him on their side.
And the fact that Netanyahu in Israel is making some kind of a de facto alliance with the Saudis, along with generals, mm-hmm. with Sisi in Egypt, who was basically put back into power by the Saudis. You know, they were furious with Obama,
right,
for the previous king, not Salman, but the guy before him, was calling up Obama and saying, let Mubarak shoot those kids in Tahrir Square. You know, they were furious that Obama let, in quotes, the Tahrir Square thing happen. And they did everything they could to undermine Morsi, who just died in a courtroom. We know that that kind of weird alliance between the Israelis, the Egyptians, and the Saudis exists. So does Israeli influence in Washington help in any way, or are our Congress people who are voting against the Saudis not, you know, in other words, is Netanyahu going to bet for MBS as much as Trump is?
I think we know that in some cases he is, and we know for a while now that Netanyahu was very opposed to the Iran deal, and in fact, he came over here and spoke to the U.S. Congress directly about it and expressed all of his concerns about the Iran deal. And so in many ways, there is this sort of incredibly odd alliance with Netanyahu and with Mohammed bin Salman now and with Egypt, as you mentioned, and in the UAE, too. I think the UAE is really getting a pass in all this, but they're incredibly influential here as well. And you know, all these countries have been really, really vying for the U.S. to go to war with Iran. And somehow forgetting that we still have troops on the ground in Iraq. We haven't right. ended the first war we started in the Middle East, and yet all of these countries there are very eager for the U.S. to come in and fight another one for them. And
sure.
and again, I keep going back to, is this really in the American interest? And for me, at least, the answer is no.
Well, of course, just in closing, the Senate will vote on Thursday on more than a dozen resolutions aimed at blocking the Trump administration's sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia. So we'll stay tuned, and I thank you for joining us, Dr. Ben Freeman.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ben Freeman, who's the director and founder of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy, where he works to expose how foreign governments are influencing U.S. public policy and elections. Previously, the National Security Fellow at the Project on Government Oversight, where he spearheaded the Foreign Influence Database. He's the author of The Foreign Policy Auction. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Kiev, Ukraine, to get a reaction to today's report from the Dutch Joint Investigative Team on the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner by Russian intelligence officers. There's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin?
repatriation. What is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Kiev is Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you. Very nice to hear you again.
So the report just came out from the joint investigative team, the Dutch JIT, as it's called. It's been 5 years since the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down in eastern Ukraine, killing all 290 people aboard from various countries. And they have named three Russians, Igor Girkin, Sergei Dubinsky, and Oleg Bulatov, along with a Ukrainian, Leonid Kachenko. But it does seem that the coverage in terms of cell phone intercepts was fairly thorough, and that some of the people that they've named, particularly the ones that these characters were reporting into, because many of them were working for or were part of the pro-Russian separatist group in eastern Ukraine. One was the head of intelligence, the other one was the defense minister. But what I find particularly disturbing is their connections to serving GRU military intelligence officers who they were in communications with. What struck you most about this report, Anders?
Well, first of all, I'm happy to see that there are concrete people named. I was afraid that the Dutch would be too scared for foreign policy reasons not to do so. They've been extremely cautious since they have taken 5 years to do this investigation that Pelling character did effectively in a couple of months. Secondly, I'm very happy to see that Igor Girkin, who was a made culprit, Russian foreign intelligence official and colonel, that he is named as a major culprit, and the two other Russians are being named. So this is a Russian government operation. That's how it must be seen. I think that's the most important point. Then the third point is that I would have liked to see more senior Russian officials being named, as Bellingcat have done. This was part of a Kursk military operation that is based in the Russian city of Kursk that undertook it, and that is not a big name. But on the whole, this is a big step forward.
Well, Bellingcat seemed to name a couple of Russian officers, Nikolai Delfin Tachev and Oleg Orion. I guess there's a nickname, Ivanikov. I don't know which one of those it was, that when they were reporting in, they said, we have the birdie, meaning the plane, thinking it was a Ukrainian military aircraft. And then they fired the Buk missile. And then bodies and aircraft parts start raining down, and they look at the IDs on the body and realize, and they're dressed as tourists, not as Ukrainian military personnel. And that's when they start to panic, and then they call their superiors. And one of them, I'm not sure which one it is, basically, you know, they read the IDs on the wallets and say, this, you know, these are university students in Holland. And the Russian officer said, oh, no, they're spies. I mean, what kind of mentality is that?
Well, it's a tough mentality. But the big thing here is really that this was a high Russian military operation that was planned. Then what we don't know, what you touch upon, is why it was planned. And here there are two basically different ideas. One idea is that they didn't know what they would do. They were incompetent, which is most easily understood. The other is that they were trying to get a passenger plane in order to aggravate the situation and cause other political problems. which is more conspiratorial. So when we don't know the second, we tend to believe that it was a mistake. But we have to recognize we don't know.
Well, my impression was that the reactions, once they realized what they'd done, first indicating that they thought it was a military plane, and secondly, when they realized it was a passenger plane, they were in a state of panic. It seems the more likely explanation is that they weren't intending to shoot down an international passenger plane, but they, of course, to this day, they're denying it. The Russian foreign ministry is saying this is all lies, etc. What do you think the preponderance of the evidence indicates here?
I think that is the most likely, but you always have a possibility that the people on the ground, they thought they were doing something different than the people in Moscow who ordered them to shoot down. So I think that's a big conclusion. That does not seem to be clear from the evidence presented today by the Dutch prosecutors. It is that this was a planned Russian action and that it was done centrally and it was done by the Russian military. And then we don't know if it was because of a mistake or if it was because they had some greater conspiracy. It's always easier to believe that it was not a great conspiracy, but that it was simply crudeness.
But if it were a more sinister explanation, what would the motives be for the Russians to shoot down a passenger jet?
Well, there are a few people, for example, my good friend Professor Paul Gregory at Hoover Institution at the Stanford University has argued that the Russians wanted to shoot down a passenger jet because this was done on Ukrainian ground with arms that the Ukrainians could have access to. They do have access to books, but there was no Ukrainian book available to shoot down any plane at the time. So that the Russians said, this is how crude the Ukrainians are. How can you possibly do anything in favor of the Ukrainians? So that would have been the purpose. Admittedly, this is a bit far-reaching conspiracy theory, as the Russians are very good at conspiracy theories.
Well, I don't know whether you've watched the HBO series Chernobyl, Anders Asland, but it sort of feels like this all over again, you know, the lying, the cover-ups, even in the case of Chernobyl lying to Gorbachev. It doesn't feel like the Russians have learned anything, particularly with their strident denials coming out today from the foreign ministry. You know, the Dutch and the Australians have made it clear that they hold Russia responsible. There isn't that sort of a change from the Soviet days in terms of that sort of reflexive cover-up. They do something incredibly stupid or dangerous or reckless or callous and then just deny, deny, deny.
Yeah, there are considerable similarities. I actually lived in Moscow at the time of a Chernobyl accident, and I remember I was at the Swedish embassy then as a Swedish diplomat, and we were the first people who knew about the Chernobyl catastrophe because it was reported first by the Swedish seismic authority. And I took a taxi, and I told the taxi driver about what had happened. And this is typical. First, he immediately believed me, a foreigner that I had never seen before. And I tell him that there has been a nuclear catastrophe in Chernobyl. And then he told me in just one thing, that they never tell us anything. And this was the sense of a situation. But today it is different, and it's different in a rather interesting way. At that time, as my sensible taxi drivers said, they didn't tell people anything. Today they tell the people massive lies. And this makes it more easy for people to say, what is this? In the Soviet Union, first, they didn't have any alternative information. And secondly, the authorities rather played everything down and didn't say anything. So therefore, I think that they are exposing themselves worse today. And we are seeing, I'm in Kiev as we speak, and we are seeing that President Zelensky, who is Jewish, Russian speaker, and popularly elected president of Ukraine with 73% of the votes, that he attracted enormous attention in Russia. How can this be? Somebody coming from nowhere, coming from outside, and he's elected president, and he actually gets the power of the president. So I think that the big point here is that Russia is more shaky, and it's more vulnerable than we tend to think, because they lie too much, more than the Soviet Union did, and they have exposed themselves, showing that they do have democracy around the corner.
Well, the lying, of course, is systemic, and it comes from what the Russians refer to as political technologists, in the case of this theater director, Surkov, who is the sort of propaganda guru of Putin's. And it's often been said that nothing is true and everything is possible, that they deliberately lie and create these kind of scenarios just to keep people confused all the time. And we have it to some extent here. We have a liar in chief. Our president has told over 10,000 lies, according to one calculation, and he did a whole bunch of lying yesterday in the launch of his 2020 campaign in Orlando. But he still has some solid support in this country, maybe 40%. Are you telling us, Anders Aslan, that the Russian people are tiring of this kind of being constantly manipulated by lies, that they're starting to sort of wake up? Because in this country, one would hope that the people who blindly support Donald Trump would eventually recognize that he's been lying to them.
Yeah, I think you're right, Ian. I think that we're seeing it, but we are at the early stages. So comparing with when I lived in the Moscow in the mid-1980s, this is like 1986. We are far... when not at all close to 91 as yet. And we can see that the Russian protests as yet, they are against various environmental problems, primarily, as was the case in 1986. They have not gone broader to big social economic questions. But we're also seeing this, that public sentiment is dead, and we can see as an example that the Kremlin Konstitution, as it's called, was recently reporting that the trust in Putin has fallen to 31.7%. And you know, Ian, what does the Kremlin do then? They change the definition of trust, and they got it up to 72%. Hmm. So when they show that they are so weak and they do feel a need to falsify the statistics, when we see that these people are getting weaker.
Well, with the foreign ministry today, the Russian foreign ministry is saying this report by the Dutch JIT is absolutely unfounded accusations. No concrete evidence this time was shown to back up such unlawful statements. I don't know how that's playing in Russia, but how is it playing in Kiev? What's this local response in Ukraine?
Yeah, I looked a bit on the television today, and it's surprisingly quiet. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of, haven't they figured it out before? Why should we be bothered? So I think that the reports today are of much greater international importance than of importance in Ukraine. The Ukrainians know.
And how is this new president doing? There were some concerns that a comedian with no political experience who played a comedian who becomes a politician, or in fact becomes the president in a TV show, life then imitated art, and he, this comedian became the president, won a substantial victory. You mentioned that he's Jewish, which I guess is unusual. And there were some concerns that the oligarch who owns the TV network might have undue influence over him because the country's been basically under some form of oligarchical kleptocracy, which is a situation that is rampant in Russia itself. How's he shaping up?
Well, the big issue now is what will happen with the parliamentary elections. He has called for parliamentary elections on the 21st of July. It's not obvious that he has the right. So the current talk of the town is that one of the losing parties currently ruling the country has been paying off the judges in the Constitutional Court, which unfortunately is a standard procedure in this country. And the latest news I hear is that 7 out of 18 Constitutional Court judges have been paid, and that they need to buy 3 more. And the question is if they can buy 3 more until the end of next week. So this is the kind of a situation. And strangely, there are no foreign powers here. There are nobody saying, no, you can't do like that. And the Constitutional Court, which made itself completely infamous in October 2010 by abolishing the Constitution that they were supposed to protect. They are still there, they're still active, and this is a big question, what will happen. But the general atmosphere is that we want to kick out the establishment. So we are now seeing 2 anti-establishment parties. First, Zelensky, servant of the people, gaining massive support, perhaps majority. And then a West Ukrainian Liberal Party voice under the rock star Slava Karchuk that is also rising. And so we can see here several of the former parties just disappearing, and instead we get young anti-establishment democratic liberal protest coming to the force.
Well, as crazy as it might seem in Ukraine, what is crazier than having a president of the United States who his own intelligence services, particularly Cyber Command, who have planted malware in the Russian energy grid as a warning to Russia's interference in the United States? They can't even share that information with their own president because they're worried, one, that he'll overrule them, and two, that he might share this intelligence with the Russians. And it's gotten so bad now that British intelligence, MI6, is not sharing intelligence with the CIA because they're worried that Trump is going to tell the Russians. So as surreal as things may seem in Ukraine, they're pretty surreal here in the United States.
Indeed. And what is very exciting here in Kiev is it's so open. You can figure it all out. Everything is being discussed, and there are no things that are prohibited. It's a very exciting time in Ukraine.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you very much. I'm grateful that you were able to stay up late to talk to us, and I very much appreciate it.
My great pleasure as well, Lucien.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva and Moscow, and serves as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. And he joined us from Kiev in the Ukraine. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.